Hi, good evening, everyone. This is John Campbell calling you on Miracle Hour on bbsradio.com. This is the program where we talk to very interesting people who've been instrumental on this journey of awakening that I've had. And we welcome listeners all over the world. And tonight, it's a little bit different because I'm going back a little bit further in my journey and then it leaps forward. And I was thinking about the program before we got on, and I was thinking about kind of the confusion I had when I first woke up to the spiritual. And I used to think, oh, you know, when I got on a spiritual path, and that person's not on a spiritual path, and this one is on a spiritual path, which I think actually now is not actually true, because we're all on a spiritual path from the moment we're here. It's just a continual spiritual path in my book, and we are spiritual beings having a human experience, and those experiences take us different places, and it's just a question of whether we become conscious of it or not. And one of the challenges I've had, and I know a lot of people have, that when they wake up to the spiritual, it's sometimes a real challenge to balance that, living in the what looks to be the real world, the material world, but we know, those of us have understood that it's a bit illusionary, and also to follow our spiritual practices. But somebody asked me the other day, well, you know, what is it that gets people to kind of start to think a little bit deeper? And I think the answer to that is pretty universal, people I'm talking to. And it's normally when people start to ask a question, two questions really, is who am I and why am I here? Those are the two questions that I hear time and time again that somebody sort of started to ask themselves. Or the other one is there must be more to life than this. You know, we come in and we do this and we do that and we end up just dying. And that's normally the questions that start to get people doing an inner search. And one of the things I've noticed as well is that companies and organizations are starting to ask those same questions. And it's fantastic. And I am so excited because I came from the corporate world myself. And I find it just amazing what's happening in business, in the business world. And today, I've got a guest for you, an amazing guy who I first came to know when I was in the oil business myself, trading in oil. And I can say that without a question, our connection was more than just business, always was. And interestingly, when I eventually made a change in direction in my life and I got this passion for education and re-education, I ended up reconnecting with this lovely man and his family, because as you all know, you know, the school and kids are my passion and Mary's passion. And I went to see this guy and his family because they have three beautiful children and also had concerns about their education. And yeah, we go back quite a long way, and his company is doing some amazing things. So without any further ado, I'm going to introduce you to him. His name is Frank Runger, and he's talking to us from London, England. And it's wonderful to have you on the show, Frank.
Hi, good evening, John. I just hope that people, your listeners, don't have the same static noise that I have, which must be inherited by BT or something on a cheap landline. Good evening, everybody. My name is Frank Runger. I'm 41 years old, and I know John since what seems to be an eternity. I would say about 15 years we go back. I'm married since 1992, and I've got three kids, aged 13, 11, and 5.
Thank you, Frank. That's a lovely introduction, and don't worry about the static because I can't hear any of it. You are clear as a bell, my friend. Clear as a bell.
Excellent.
Clear as a Frank Lampard rocket, we'll say. Some of them won't understand that, but you would.
No, exactly.
That was lovely. So, Frank, when I think back, I guess 15 years, it's amazing how quickly it goes, you know. What I'd like you to do, if you could, kind of give a little bit about your background, because you know what I think of what you're doing there in Trafigura and all the rest of it. But how did you first, you know, I mean, what sort of age did you go into training to do what you did in the oil industry, or you know, what happened for you? Did you go to university, or what was your kind of journey?
Okay, my journey was that I have never been a liker of school. So in Germany, if you don't like school, but you do what most of your listeners would relate to as being, I think, the high school equivalent before you have to make a choice to go to university. I didn't like that I had enough of school, so I was always a more practical person in life. In Germany, you have to take an apprenticeship regardless of what job you want to choose. So whether you want to become a bricklayer or a roofer, or whether you want to become a banker or work in the insurance business, you have to pick a job. My father was running a cleaning company, and one of their customers was an oil company in Germany. So I started my apprenticeship with them, which obviously involves interesting jobs like photocopying, making coffee, working the switchboard and the mailroom, which is a great part of additional education. At that point in my life, I first came across what I've shared with you in the past, which is bad education. You're meant to be going to a specialized school that teaches you more about your forthcoming job. And it was a disaster because the teachers there were absolute failures in their own professional right, and that's why they became teachers. So obviously the wrong motivation. Then I stayed with the company with another mutual friend of ours, which hopefully you will one day get on the show as well. And that guy saw something in me, which I still today don't quite understand what he saw, but he saw that I would be a good person to help him working on the trading floor. He, by that time, was already a trader himself. In Germany, we do obviously in between have to do some military service, which I'm not going to bore your listeners with, but that's how I got into the world of oil trading. And I did that for about 4 or 5 years before we stumbled across certain Mr. John Campbell, who at that time was still very active in oil trading in Nigeria. And from there on, John and I were the other John, the one that your listeners, I don't know how much they've learned about that John yet. We're trying to do Dallas-style oil trading. I stayed another 5 years in that company in Germany. Then the signs were that they would basically close down the company. At that point, the only time in Europe, in any case, if you wanted to stay in oil trading, was to look towards London. And since John was living in London, we were actually using his your former place, as a place to stay, because at that time, against common belief, oil traders didn't make all that much money. So we drove over from Germany to meet people in a company that had just started, a company that goes by the name of Trafigura, which is a terrible name for a company. Means nothing, but was the only one available when the company was founded. And I've been there since 13 years, doing all sorts of things, traveling all around the world, meeting lots of fantastic people. And today I'm the managing director of their London office and member of the board.
Wow, well, that was a very, very quick resume of a lot of years, Frank. Thanks for that. And so obviously it's different for me because I know quite a bit of what you're talking about, but just a couple of things. First of all, I think we are interested. The listeners would be interested. Did you actually have to do military training, Frank?
Yes. In Germany at the time, it was mandatory to do either 18 months of military service or 24 months of the civil service, which would have meant that you would have to work in a hospital or in a home for retired or work with handicapped people. And I would say without shame that at that point in time, I didn't quite finish my own journey with myself. And I thought to myself, and there was a lot of peer pressure from the outside world, that people always told you if you did not do the military service and you did the alternative service, people in your employment later on would look down on you and they would take that as a reason. If you were a contender amongst others to put you back at the end of the pile.
Right.
And I have to say, however, that from a pure experience of learning how to live with others, forget all the military aspect, which I've absolutely had no pleasure in doing, but from living socially together with seven other grown-up men sharing a room, skills about respect for others, respect for their own space, respect for their different sorts and their different behavior patterns, because you get mixed with all sorts of different backgrounds. I mean, the only thing that puts you together is an age group. That was an amazing experience, and I think something that people could share more. I mean, obviously not in the form. It doesn't have to be in a uniform, and certainly not with a gun. But to learn values like respect for others is something I've taken away from that time.
Yeah. Well, that's lovely, and it's lovely that you're able to see that part of it and not sort of lump it all as though that they're all this warmongering. You know, you were able to see the positive parts, and I totally agree with you, because as you know, my son Paul is also ex-military, and I can see very clearly, I can see very clearly the amazing abilities that he took out of the military. So what age were you then, Frank? What age were you when you started that?
I did it between the age of 18 to 20. So you're still very, very young as a person at that point.
Yeah, yeah. And when you were talking about the oil companies, that was, I guess, Stinnes, was it?
Stinnes, exactly. That was Stinnes Interoil in Hamburg, together with our friend Roald.
So it was Roald who you said saw this in you and took it took you into the trading.
Yes, but that was later. There's another thing that came out of my time there, which is my wife. As you've, I mean, you listeners have to know that you and I are obviously quite close, and you're a mentor to me and somebody who I share a lot of my way with together. And you've once taught me that nothing in life is coming as a surprise, but there is always a deeper meaning in it. And when I joined the company, I met my current wife, and we shared 6 months working together in the same company before she moved on. So many good things happened whilst I was there.
Yeah. And what was Carolina doing there?
She was doing a job that your listeners would refer to as operations traffic. I mean, making sure that ships going from A to B and people go on the ships and making sure that they're actually moving.
Oh, okay. So, I think you had told me that I had forgotten that you met Carolina there. Well, that was certainly nothing happened by accident. So that was a wonderful meeting. And Roald was already in the company then, was he?
Yeah, he was already in the company. He started there 2 years ahead of me. And since he had done a different form of a degree, he started at a different position in the company. So not only did he start earlier, but he started at a higher position in the company, if you so will.
Yeah, and then you obviously got to start trading in the trading company, and that's when you and I met, and we started to do business together. And it is interesting, you know, because you know I don't know how familiar you are with the kind of spiritual beliefs, but basically it has its belief and or knowing that we're on a continuous journey, and we keep coming back to learn different lessons and all the rest of it, and we'll often come back and interact with people in different ways who we've been with before, and we may have been with them in different situations. We may have been married to them, or we may have been the child of them, or we may have been the parent of them, you know. And then we come back and meet them in different ways. And I can certainly say in my own experience that there's people I know, you know, it's that feeling of instant connection, instant understanding, that there's no you know, there's just a knowingness that you're in tune, and I think that's what happened. It's certainly what I felt with you guys, and that continued. And you know, there are many times I've looked back on when I was in that business, and you know, I have to acknowledge that the fun, you know, we had a lot of fun. And that's, a lot of people get very heavy in the spiritual world, you know, and it gets all very serious, but it's such an important part of spirituality is having fun and joy, you know. And, you know, I honestly can look back and say, yeah, I had a lot of fun there. I remember one time conducting the band at a company invite. You took us to the Oktoberfest.
Yeah.
I don't know
how much your listeners already know about the full circle that John Campbell has done. I don't know which part of the journey I'm coming in that you've taken them.
Well, you're coming in, Frank, where you are and where you were, you know. I think that's the interesting thing. I mean, that is the interesting part, is that, you know, and I hear this time and time again, but people who get onto this path, they move on and they go back, and then they often invariably come back to different points, you know, different connections that they had right at the beginning, and that it was necessary to move on and then come back. And, you know, it's a common factor I heard about, you know, I've heard about this, you know. But I certainly, you know, certainly had some great times there. And if I remember rightly, when you came over, you and Roel came over and we met up, I seem to remember it was a Sunday, and you were talking about, you were looking at the possibility of moving across to Trafigura. Trafigura, can you tell me, had they just recently formed then, or how old were they?
Yes, the company at that time was only about 2 years old, so the company is now 15 years old, and I've been 13 years with them, and they were a startup company, basically formed out of an existing company, and they were at the very beginning of their journey, and they were looking for people to come and join them, and Roald and I were crazy enough to jump on the opportunity, and both of us have actually never regretted it.
It is an amazing company, you know, when you think how it was formed and everything else. And I'll talk a little bit later about the connection with the school, which I also think is mind-boggling. I really do. That is something which, you know, and how that came about. And so when you came over, how many people were there in the company at that time?
I was the employee number 31, and Roald was employee number 32. Don't ask me why they choose that way around, but today there is about 1,000 of us.
My God, that's amazing. And that is in how many years?
That is in 13 years of me being there.
Wow, that is amazing. And how many countries are you in around the world, Frank?
In 35 countries.
35 countries, wow. That is incredible. And I guess the thing I'd like to... You trade, in addition to oil, you also trade metals, don't you?
Yeah, we trade oil, metals, and minerals, which is the raw form of metals.
Yeah. And you've always kept the company in private ownership, and you found that that's really stood you in good ground, hasn't it?
Oh yes. Obviously, we work in a field, John, that as you will appreciate, that is not exactly highly regarded. Oil companies, and especially the ones which are private, will always have the tainting that they are sleazy and they've got things to hide. And if your listeners will Google our name, there's not just good news coming up in there. But we're not hiding from them, and we are human beings, despite the fact that we have a private name that we all work for. But it's formed of 1,000 human beings, and we do as many good things as we do bad things. It's just a part of life that people like to publicize the things which they can sell things with more than the ones that that are the normal thing that we go about.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the things that I think is very important to emphasize here, you know, is a lot of people can go into judgment, but when you are, you know, when you are running these massive organizations and with massive numbers of people, you know, there are going to be mistakes, and everyone makes mistakes. And the thing I admire about your company is that they don't try and hide from them, and acknowledge that. But the thing that I really want to focus on today is the good stuff you do, and I'd like to get you to talk to the listeners about forming a foundation, or you've formed a foundation. Tell us a little bit about that, how that came about, and you know what the thoughts are behind it.
Yeah, I mean, as any big corporation, we will always be accused that we do good stuff because we've got a bad conscience, and again, I leave it up to the individuals, the ones who will ever meet me. I'm very happy to spend some more time about it. It's obviously not the case. We know that we have a huge social responsibility in all these countries that we're working. And the first time it really came about was when the tsunami happened in Southeast Asia on Christmas Day. And we, for the first time, asked ourselves, because a lot of our staff asked us and said, what are we going to do? Because the whole world felt that they had to do something. And we just realized that we were completely inept, because we're good in what we're doing, which is trading, but we're not very good in helping. There was a huge desire to help, but as many other people, we were sort of paralyzed. And the one thing that I think everybody can relate to is you know you want to help, but you want to help direct. And all of us that we want to help, is, we always will say, yeah, but I'd rather give it to somebody I know that it helps directly. We don't believe, yet again, in organizations. And if so, we like to think that the ones which are bigger and more publicized are the ones which will help more direct. And we went a different way. We built a school in Indonesia that was destroyed in Aceh. We did that direct with the people there. Again, the problem is, who does it? We don't have people who are trained in doing this, but it was very important for us that the money would actually go where we wanted it to go. And then the other thing we did is, we've got a colleague of mine who is originally from Sri Lanka, and we bought a substantial amount of new fishing boats to the fishermen. And the red tape that we had to go through there to actually help directly is quite incredible, because against common belief, a lot of people don't want people to help directly, because they regard these things as their industry and their trade. And again, I don't want to be negative about them, but
I understand exactly that.
Some of them, their intention, I question. So that's how we started it, and from there on, big and small events in the world, we have helped directly. We've done a large sum of money. We've given to an art school in New Orleans to rebuild that one after the hurricane. We've just done a big aid program to help the people after the earthquake in Peru. But again, what we've done, John, is we said, look, what big corporations do, they have a foundation where there are people in there who deal with these things professionally,
yeah,
and more evenly, because otherwise people will always just tend to look for helping in case of disaster, and they neglect what is really important as well, which is the day-to-day help, which we do a lot of as well. We help a lot in terms of on schools for autistic people, special needs. So what we have pledged is that we will put 1% of our net earnings into a foundation every year. And then we've asked, we've done a poll, of, I don't know whether there's a word that is, I mean, we've done a, what is it? I don't know whether it's an American.
A poll.
And asked our own people what they would like us to do with the money. And the three things that always come up, it's education, it's children, and obviously it's always something when a crisis happens, that's where people want to help.
Sure.
So that foundation is formed now, and people will go about it. And one of the projects that has been put forward is the, I don't know whether your listeners know that, the Angel Project, John, is your schooling project, which you and I have spent many discussions about, and hopefully that's going to be one that will be picked.
Yeah, that's wonderful, Frank, and that's fantastic. And you know, it is true what you're saying, that you know, the difficulty in these things is making sure that everything gets to where it's supposed to get. You know, without having to dwell on that. But you know, I mean, I think this is why Bob Geldof had some of the challenges he had. You know, and got quite angry about some of the stuff. So, and I think by doing the foundation, that is a way which I really got what you said, Frank, when you said about, you know, you are traders and you're great businessmen, you're great traders, and you know you haven't got those kind of skills, and that's the basic problem with our education system, which is why I'm passionate, Mary is passionate about showing another way to educate kids, is because we tend to force kids through a system where they've all got to have the same skills. I mean, it just doesn't work. You know, it's about putting round pegs in round holes and square pegs in square holes, and that is a skill as a teacher or as an industry leader, I think, it needs to be done. So I think that's fantastic that you recognize that. But the point I want to emphasize is that what's wonderful is that you've got to have the right heart, because if you haven't got the heart, these things don't mean anything. And that's the beautiful thing that I've always noticed within the company, you know, even before you got the foundation up and running, that heart was there. And I think with now the foundation, I believe, and this is what I was doing a lecture once about new ways of doing business, and I've spoken to you, I know, many times privately about this. I think it's all about focus. It's, everything is about focus. And once the focus has shifted, and there is a higher purpose, what I call a higher purpose, which doesn't mean, you know, we're suddenly becoming, you know, godlike or angel or whatever. It's not about that, but it's that we start to prioritize people before profit, and that profit is an essential part of business. But, you know, where you start getting companies, and I don't want to get into names, or where they'll start compromising, staff don't answer you don't get an answer on phones, you get machines and all the rest of it, because basically, you know, they're wanting to increase profit at the cost of people. And I think the beautiful thing with putting a foundation in place is you absolutely automatically, in one fell swoop, you suddenly make that is the purpose, because that amount that you're putting in there is coming off your guys straight in, straight off your top line there. And I think then amazing things happen. Amazing things happen within the consciousness of the people. This is what I've experienced anyway. People suddenly have become inspired. You know, they become personally interested in the different projects. And this, of course, generates tremendous energy. You know, and there's other companies are finding this. So it's a really exciting thing. And the amazing thing is, I think I'm correct to say, you're the first private oil company to do such a thing.
That is correct. I mean, again, we as you said, we are private, but again, it's not a state secret neither that in our company most of the employees are shareholders. So we run our company slightly different to a lot of other companies. Now, some of our competitors obviously run it similarly, but with us, the people who work in Trafigura make the company. It's different if people work for Shell or for Exxon or for Chevron, where they might be a shareholder because they bought themselves a stock ticket. With us, our staff makes the company. And it's one thing that we really believe in that makes a difference in Trafigura. It's the us feeling in the company, and we feel very close together in times of crisis and then in times of joy.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And I just wanted to say about the connection, you know, when I eventually came to see you about these new kids. I call them new kids. They're often termed indigo children. That's a term which is becoming very much more known now, so I feel free to use it. This is not something in the imagination, Frank. This is really happening. There is a brand of children around today that just do not get nurtured in the traditional system. I mean, I believe all kids are born genius, you know, and our job as parents and teachers and educators is to find that area where their genius at, you know, and help them develop that. But the amazing connection with us is that I had been long thinking about there was needed to be a change in education. I got that knowing this just like you. It's very interesting, actually, that you mentioned you had the same dislike for the education system as a child that I did. I think that's a common denominator. And I'd been consciously thinking about, education. And then suddenly I met a woman on a workshop that I was doing, a rebirthing workshop, American woman, and she told me about this school in India, the KPM approach to children, utilizing the KPM approach to children. And I was so inspired, and I knew that I had to see the school, and I eventually went down because there's one school in Texas using the approach. That's the only one outside India at the moment. And I went down, and I spent a couple of days at the school in Texas, and I stayed with this lady at her apartment. And it came out in the conversation that her ex-husband used to be a colleague of your colleagues in their previous company. I mean, is that not bizarre? Did you know that, Frank?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's actually the guy. Unfortunately, passed away now. He got killed in a private air crash. But his name was Bob Thomason.
Say it again.
His name was Bob Thomason. He was the lawyer. Working together with Claude and Mark Crandell and Eric de Turckheim at the time, you know?
Ah, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that was an incredible connection, you know. So, when I saw the school and that, and then I came up and visited you and Caroline and showed you the DVD, you'd already started to have some reservations, I think, about where your kids were schooled. But It is fascinating now, and this is information which I haven't given you yet because it's only happened since we spoke. I was contacted, I was called by ITV before I flew out, and they're making a documentary now about the Indigo children and about their education and different education approaches, so they want to do some interviews there. So that is phenomenal that this information is now going out on mainstream TV. So we need to have a chat maybe off air sometime as well. We'll talk about getting your involvement in that, because I think that would be unique. I think it's going to be a unique thing as well.
Not very much so, John.
These children are really getting some airtime now, and I think it's wonderful because, you know, and as you know, not everybody's ready to acknowledge these things, but the kids themselves are the ones that'll bring people's focus to that, you know. And I think that they... And it's happening now. It's happening before our eyes, you know.
But, John, as you and I are very... We had a lively discussion about that just the other day. It's obviously, it's now... I don't know how much of that gets, unfortunately, the news system in the United States is about as bad as the school system over here is. I don't think your listeners hear much about this, but things in the UK are getting worse and worse in terms of crime being committed by teenagers. Especially involving knives and guns, and latest thing being an 11-year-old boy that has been shot by some gang violence in Liverpool. And you and I talked about it the other day, and it's in front of everybody, because the people who first screamed about the government, because it's obviously always the government that has to fix everything to step in and get more heavy-handed, I think the sentiment of the people's opinion has shifted now much more towards the parents of those kids, and they are basically turning back and saying, "Well, it's back to the government, because they force us to live a certain life and abandon those kids." And it seems to be a hell of a vicious circle. And I'm not surprised that different ways of education will get some media coverage now, because it's very much in the spotlight in the UK at the moment.
Yeah, it is, and you know, a lot of people. Not aware. I think the last figures I saw, there are 100,000 children a year being taken out of mainstream education and being home educated or being given an alternative sort of education. And when I started to talk publicly about the KPM and about the Indigo children, I was amazed at the number of parents who actually thought that they had to, by law, send their children to school, you know, because they got information that if they didn't send if the kids didn't go to school, they'd get fined £1,000 and everything else. And of course, that's the only information they get. And of course, it's not the fact, you know, that there are hundreds and thousands of children being educated at home now. And there's an amazing organization called Education Otherwise. And you can Google them, you can get them online. I think it's just www.educationotherwise.com. And they've actually formed in order to validate all of those parents who have made that decision to educate their children outside the system. And another thing which I think the listeners would be, it's interesting for those who are particularly interested in education to know, is that I can't remember the year, but you've probably heard of Summerhill School. Have you heard of Summerhill School, Frank, on the east coast of England?
Yes, I've heard about it. I'm not even sure what I heard from you about it.
Yeah, but it was interesting because it started off in Austria, funny enough. It was from a Scotsman called A.S. Neil. But anyway, the government tried to shut Summerhill down because it employed this freedom method, you know, giving the children the freedom to choose, you know, what they wanted to do. And it went to the High Court, and the government took the school governors to the High Court to charge them, to sue them, to put a charge against them. And they actually lost the case. And it was an amazing story. The whole courtroom was full of old students came from all over the world, and they packed the courtroom. There were present-day students, you know, all age groups and teachers, and there was absolute bedlam. You can imagine this, you know, this sort of hierarchical court-type attitude, and this whole court was full of all these people passionate about this school and realized what a wonderful job it had done for them. And anyway, they lost the case, and the courtroom just exploded in cheers and everything else. And, of course, that was never advertised. And you know how the law works in UK and I think most of the world, where it works on case precedent. So there was now a precedent on the statute book, you know, where schools were, you know, parents and children were allowed to be given the freedom to choose. And that's something, as I say, which not everyone knows about, but it was a massive piece of legislation which made it more difficult, you know, obviously for the government to enforce. And I think we're going to see this more and more now. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when that documentary comes out. And Frank, the other thing I wanted to talk a little bit about, which really I love as well, is your own venture as well, which you're involved in Ghana. Tell us a little bit about how that happened and what you do and what happened with that.
Okay, I mean, it's for that your listeners need to understand that you and I have got many things in common apart from our sports club that we support. There we couldn't be in more disagreement, the two of us. But we both have a big love for Africa, yeah. And I think it's one of the most wonderful places on earth. And as I've been doing business there for a very long time, especially in a country called Ghana. Which is in the western part of Africa, which has been in the past, unfortunately, most known for providing most of the slaves during the slave trade. Unfortunately, it is a country that I've got to travel around due to my engagement in oil, and I've always tried to do my own. Foundation, if you so want, and look for something where I can give something back. Obviously, it would be a lie to say that I'm very well off in doing what I'm doing, and I again don't try to make a secret of that. But people when people earn money, they do all sorts of different things with it. Some people collect stamps, others car, others get into all sorts of trouble that we don't need to dwell on. I've always looked to give some of that back to the courses that that I like. And what we did was with a group of friends, we discovered that the government of Ghana about 10 years ago was trying to prevent the country from going into a monoculture, because what they really most export is cocoa, which you make chocolate from. It's one of the best qualities in the world, but what they were afraid of, that all the farmers would just start growing the same product. So they ordered some of the farmers to grow orange trees, like people do in Florida and in the U.S. And they did that. The problem of central government thinking there, unfortunately, was that you had so many oranges and you have got no industrial scale production with it, because for that they didn't have the money. So you have got lots of little farmers with their orange trees, and at the end of the season, they hang on the tree, falling down to the ground. And apart from some market women picking them up and selling them, they don't really know what to do with them, and they make no money out of it. So, cut a long story short, I put a couple of people, some local Ghanaian friends that I'm having, some friends from Germany who are the guys in the fruit juice business, and we come up with a plan to actually build a factory there, and that's what we have done. We finished it last year. We put a lot of goodwill into it, all of us in some form or shape felt that we would like to be connected to Ghana. I mean, some with more passion than others, and some with more commercial reason, others have to be said as well. But everybody is as fortunate as me that he can do these things not trying to earn money. And so we built a fruit processing plant, which will give thousands of farmers the opportunity to sell their oranges to us, and we make industrial-scale orange juice out of it, which then gets exported to Europe. And for me, John, that's been one of the most fantastic things I've done in my life. We've built something in the middle of nowhere, in the countryside. And yes, if people want to be cynical, they will say, well, you only did that to make money. I mean, I can say for myself that I'm honestly not interested in making money. I haven't made any money yet for a whole array of reasons. We were a bit arrogant being from Europe, thinking that once you build it, the farmers would come. But we've obviously, there's a lot of factors for those of you who have ever got the opportunity to go to Africa, they should experience it. Whilst we are all preoccupied trying to think about what's going to happen tomorrow and next week and next month and how our whole life unfolds in our eyes, people down there think about between now and the end of the day. That's about what they worry about in life. So trying to tell them that it would be a good idea to bring them the oranges next week, they just don't care. You have to pick them up from them because they don't have the infrastructure to bring them. Plus, maybe it's a good day, maybe they're in the mood, maybe they're not. So one has to really adapt for the local way of thinking, and that's what we're learning, and that's what we're doing. So you mentioned Mr. Geldof earlier, or Sir Bob Geldof, as he's known to us. And yes, once I agree with a lot of things that he's trying to do, I wasn't a big fan of these big concert and these. Yes, you make people aware, but what you really do is you provoke the guilt in people, and then they send money. And I've seen the bad things of what's happening with money in Africa, and most of it doesn't go into the right channels. I know it's a big cliche, but unfortunately, it's true as well. So what I say to people is, if they really want to help, you have to actually do it direct. Don't do it through any organizations. And that's what we're doing, John. It's a big thing. It helps tens of thousands of people. We've been building schools. We're in the process of improving the hospital in the local city where we are. It will transform a whole part of that country to something. And yes, people can say, well, it's only a drop in the ocean. But again, it's a bit what you're doing. If you have enough drops together, it makes a little cup, and then one day it makes a bucket.
Exactly. That's a wonderful place. And which part of Ghana is that in?
It's a city called Asamankese, which is about an hour and a half drive inwards from the capital, Accra.
Oh, okay. So it's not far from Accra then.
No, it's about an hour and a half drive. I mean, again, drive is the roads are reasonably good in Ghana. It's actually a very functional country, and it's English speaking, which is rare for West Africa. So it's a place really worth visiting as well.
Yeah, are you doing it in families, or I mean, are there families running different parts of this venture that you've got going?
You mean the local workers?
Yes, that's right. I think you said to me something about, you know, like the father or the grandfather, he's like an overseer and all that sort of stuff.
Oh yeah, no, you can imagine that. I mean, apart from some of the technical aspects, which is predominantly run by Brazilian people, because we bought a Brazilian plant that we've shipped there and built there. The rest of the staff is actually Ghanaian, and yes, you have entire families working in different parts of the organization, and it's a lovely thing to see, because they take their education quite seriously down there. So kids go to school. If you can give them education, they're absolutely thriving on it. They love it. They see it obviously differently. They see it as their way out of poverty. But then they have a different, I mean, John, you've lived it. They've got a different definition of poverty. What we would describe as people being poor. They are not poor because they're blessed and they live in a country which produces a lot of food, so there's nobody starving. It's obviously not what most people would define as good living standards, but they're far from being poor, and they don't feel poor. But they love education.
Yeah. Yeah, and also I think the other thing that, Frank, that I realize now, you know, maybe I wasn't so, I probably did, I was aware. I mean, they have a very powerful spiritual base, you know, whichever way it is, whether it's in various religious, you know, festivals or that, but there is tremendous spiritual base. They've got a tremendous faith there, and I think that has to be. And it was interesting to hear you say about, you know, they have to live their day, you know, just that one day, you know, up until the end of the day is how far they think. And I was smiling because in a way, that's a really enlightened way to think, you know, just for the day we would talk, you know, and not to sort of get looking too far in the future. And I can understand the challenges that brings when you're trying to to get an infrastructure run down there. But they have got, I mean, you said it at the beginning, a country. I love Africa. There's something about it, and they have a spirit within them, and the country has a spirit which is so powerful, and you can feel it, can't you, when you're down there?
Oh yeah, it's a magical place. But then again, I've been going there for a long, long time, so I might not be as impartial as other people would be.
Yeah, and who knows? I mean, if we could even, you know, that would be wonderful. Sometimes to get that to give them just an introduction to a different way of educating the kids as well, you know. Because obviously those countries take their traditional system from the British, you know, because we introduced it down there. So in the
Don't say we. Huh? Your listeners might have detected by my slight accent that I'm not British. Huh?
Oh, well, okay, sorry. Yeah, okay. I'm just thinking there. Yeah, but you know what I mean. It's it is very much an education, just as India was, you know. And interestingly, talking about education. The wise people like Gandhi, you know, I mean, Gandhi wrote a book actually warning the Indian people against following the traditional British education system, you know, and I think most people would acknowledge that that guy had a bucket full of wisdom. So it's amazing that the changes are everywhere. And when are you next going out there, Frank?
I think I'm going to be there in about 2 weeks' time next.
Oh, fantastic. Wonderful. And do you go out alone normally, or do you go out with colleagues? Or
I tend to go there with some of our other partners in those projects and try to... The problem in my part of life, and obviously it's not a problem, it's a problem of my own making, is the time that I can devote to it. Between my daytime job, my family, and projects like that, but again, we all have to do our own time management.
Yeah.
And as you know, John, mine is sometimes very tight. And I do apologize to the people who I was on the show last week and I wasn't.
Oh, that's okay. No, I think that's one of the things that. Now I understand where you got it. When you told me you've been in the military there for 2 years or whatever it was, that's where that comes from. But it is an amazing organization. And where do you see Trafigura going, Frank, in the next 5 years? Do you have any thoughts of branching out into other areas of trading? Is there any thought giving to, you know, going different types of trading?
Yeah, the big up and coming trading, which obviously is finally something that most people can relate to, and that most people want us trading companies in the oil side, especially, to do is all the alternative fuels,
yeah.
Trading carbon emissions, getting into biofuels, into ethanol, and trying to understand how all of that fits together. And again, I can bore you for more than one show, and I can tell you the pro and cons about biofuels and how things that should be very straightforward be very green. They have a huge influence in the food chain. They have a huge influence what's happening on our planet. So I am at the moment not, and I'm. Far ahead of a lot of people because I read a lot of literature about it. I haven't quite made up my mind yet whether the renewable energies are a friend or foe of our continent. Sorry, of Mother Earth, not just the continent, but our planet. That was the word I was looking for.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is a part of already your work there to investigate alternative methods and because
started, John. It's something that is going to become so big, and it's something that needs to be watched because people see it a little bit as the quick fix and the easy cure, and again, once it's got a lot of pros. Vis-a-vis fossil fuels, it does have unfortunately a lot of cons as well, which people are somewhat neglecting at the moment.
Well, Frank, we're just about coming up the end. I tell you, I'm amazed again. I guess it's because, you know, we know each other so well, but it's like flown by, absolutely flown by, and it's been a great pleasure. And I think it's lovely that our listeners get to hear such a wide range of things and to really hear about companies such as yours, people like you, because I believe that you are a credit to the commercial world generally, you know, and a leading light in the way you do things, in what you're doing. And it's always been a great pleasure to do business with you and to be a friend of yours and your family. And I really look forward to that going on for many years. Thank
okay,
you so
John,
much for coming on the show.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And one day you should invite me back, because you have dodged all the questions about what I thought about the different cycles of life and the life of John Campbell. But maybe we do that in a different show. I will tell the people how you explained to me how you did the David Blaine long time ahead of him, going without water and without food. And
I guess that I would feel is talking about me. And yeah, maybe we could do that another time. And that is true, because just before we go, folks, I'll tell you, when I first got onto this spiritual path, I scared the living daylights out of Frank. He thought I'd lost the plot, and I think I had for a little while. But, you know, it's like the balance comes back, and I'm glad to say. So, Frank, thank you so much. We will get it on again, and we can talk about football, you see, which is really...
Exactly,
so
for four people
week.
Really well.
And John, thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot, and lots of love.
Yeah. Lots of love to you, Frank. Take care. God bless you, my friend.
Bye. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.